There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine, to start with, is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 65. In this program, we pay another visit to Tor Kenward of Tor Kenward Family Wines in St. Helena.
Tor Kenward is a great person to just sit and chat with. It's been 2 years, so this is our second visit to Tor's home in St. Helena to talk about Tor Kenward Family Wines. Family is big with Tor, especially as his daughter is getting married this year, and will celebrate with a wine made just for her. And if you're lucky enough to have sampled his wines, you know what a special bottle that'll be.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Tor, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I'm starting the interval off. My mouth is full.
You're having a little Point Reyes tome.
And what am I drinking?
That is a Chardonnay that, for the bottle that I opened for you, it says Molly and Ian's Cuvée. It's a wedding cuvée. My daughter's getting married in a month. So.
Oh, congratulations.
But the wine is what, for the consumers out there, know it as, is our 2010 Torchiana Chardonnay. Comes from a vineyard in Carneros that a very good friend of mine, Larry Hyde, famous grower, introduced me to. I love his vineyard. I always wanted one particular block, which he said, it's yours, Tor, as soon as that other person drops it, which the other person will never drop it, not in my lifetime. So he says, I'll plant you a new piece next to Mark Humbert, which has been very successful for Mark. And in the meantime, I have a friend of mine that I gave all this early budwood to, it's almost 30 years ago now. My best budwood, he planted a vineyard. It only gets a ton, 2 tons an acre. But if you'd like to try it, he's looking for a new home for his fruit. So we tried it in 2005, loved it. And I've been working with his vineyard since. So it's Steve Barasini's vineyard, Hyde Selection Cuttings, and Torchiana is the name that we give it usually.
It's very tasty. I like it quite a bit.
It's got a minerality to it, which I love. I like minerality more than I do the tropical fruit, you know, that sort of tutti frutti.
Yeah, where they get a little bit too heavy on the fruit. Something about like this, what I like about it, and I could tell just from drinking it here, is that sometimes whites, I can't go very long with them. I can't get into a second glass. And this is something that has a bit more of a robustness to it. It's got body, which I just seem to run into that with whites. You ever run into that yourself?
I love white wines that have good crispness to them. And I don't say that where it has to be acidic, but it needs to have, you know, some structure to it. And that structure is what I think, for me anyway, is what begs the second glass. When it's cumbersome, then you're not interested in the second glass anywhere near as much as you would be with. It's got a nice balance to it.
You know, it's not something that's going to wear you down.
Bingo, yeah.
I should probably say we are here at the home of Tor Kenward, Tor Kenward Family Wines. Thanks for having us back in again. It was 2 years ago that we were here last.
How time flies when you get to be an old man, an old winemaker.
Yeah, a little old winemaker, exactly.
Doesn't seem that long ago, but anyhow.
Not at all. So what's new? What's going on? Obviously, your daughter's getting married, which is nice.
Yeah, if you get to the family side of the business, that's certainly huge. I have a daughter and a son, and this obviously is a big deal in our life and hers. that's happening. My son, we're just talking about him. He's now working a production company because he loves film in San Francisco, and they seem to like him, so that's working well. And going back to the wine business, it's been immensely successful. We're mostly mailing list, as your audience might know, and we tend to sell out of the wines very quickly, so it's good. Part of the secret is not making a lot.
Of course, it's also being able to keep that company fluid, too, in the process, right?
Yes, yes. While you're building a company in the wine business, it does take a couple years where there's a lot going out and not a lot coming back in.
Well, what is that old saying about a small fortune and a large fortune and all that whole thing?
I know a lot of people that will say that is an absolute truth, which is the saying is simply the way to make a small fortune in the wine business is to invest a large fortune.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
We all have a large fortune laying around. Well, if you have to invest in a business, the wine business is a great one to get into as long as you have that passion for it.
You know, and I've been in the business now probably 37 years, taken early work, moved up here about 36 years ago. And I'm asked occasionally to consult for people getting into the business, or actually sometimes for people that have been in the business for a decade or two. And the advice that I always give them is, you better be very passionate about what you want if you want to get in the wine business. You better be willing, certainly the first decade or couple decades, to really put in some time. And that's where I see the big mistakes made, is that the ones getting in, they don't know the business all that well. They know they love wine. They want to see their name on a label, and they just don't want to put in the real time. It's sort of like, I'll do it on the weekend. You can't do that. You've really got to put in as much time as you've ever put in probably in your life to really do it right. So it's easy to work with clients once they've agreed that that's what they're willing to do. And then you can sort of step forward and say, I'll consult with you a little bit, get you started and move on. And usually it works if they're willing to put the time in.
Would you say a fair comparison or analogy, I should say, would be you're a parent. You've got two kids. I am two. I have one. Your business is your baby, and it has to be raised that way, just like those formative years where everything is so important. It's very comparable, wouldn't you say, as the years go by?
It's funny. I hadn't thought about it. Yeah, it's like raising a child. And the early years are very, very important. It's funny. It's how you get out of the chute in this business, which is the early years, which makes a big difference on how you're going to be perceived and how the next 10 years are going to go. If it's a wobbly start, it stays wobbly for a period of time.
Wobbly not good.
No, wobbly's not good in the wine business anyway. Wobbly can work for a few other businesses, but the wine business is not kind to wobbly.
No, and I think especially because these days there's so much more competition. I mean, obviously from when you started, both with your time at Behringer as well as your time, in your own label, I mean, you've seen a world of change.
Yes.
And far more competition than ever.
When I moved to the Napa Valley, there were less than 50 wineries. Now, this is 36 years ago. Now, I think in the Napa Valley Vintners Association alone, which is not all the wineries, just those that want to sign up and be part of the trade organization, and it's a good one, I believe there's over 600.
Wow, that's even, I was expecting you to say around 5, but...
No, I think there's 600 members now.
So it's grown even since we started getting involved with it.
Yeah, every month there's a notice from the Vintner Association, welcome our new members, boom, 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 boom. And it's certainly not an industry where it's suddenly, leveling or declining in any way, where you see less labels. It's an industry right now that continues to grow, more and more labels every single month, every single year. Obviously, there will be a point where that's going to have to, something will happen.
Dam's got to break somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it still dominated by family efforts, though, from what it's been known for that in the past?
Yeah, Napa Valley, and that's where we are right now, and we're in the center of it, which is kind of an interesting, you're almost dead center right here, represents only 4% of the California wine industry.
It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Lots of people that'll be listening to this will go, I thought it was much larger than that. But it's 4% of the wine industry. In Napa Valley, most of the wineries if you want to take sheer numbers and do percentages, are family owned.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to see that.
Yeah, it is nice. I think when you move into other appellations, some other appellations are like that, you know, mostly family driven, small. But there are some appellations where I would say the Central Valley area where you'll have some very, very large wineries looking at the industry from another perspective, mm-hmm. which is more numbers than...
Different concept.
Different concept, yeah. Different business plan.
Mm-hmm. I'm step aside for one quick second. This cheese is really good. Boy, is it creamy. It has just got such a wonderful creaminess to it.
Yeah, well, that's it's a small little cheesemaker over in Marin area that is just... one of the top in California. They've won a lot of awards, national awards, too.
Well, there's so much similarity, wouldn't you say, between cheese making and wine making?
Cheese has really taken off the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Do you think that's maybe hand in hand?
Well, I think it's wine, it's cheese, it's restaurants, it's the vegetables. They're looking at more and more heirloom type of plantings now, from tomatoes to kale to whatever. So everything is getting, you know, how can we push it? How can we push it? How can we get better? How can we get more interest out there? And you get, in California, I think the climate is such that it really does invite that.
Mm.
I hope that stays that way
so
for
a
period of time.
Well, and also the concept of being local, fresh, not shipped.
Well, that farm to table, I think Chez Panisse started in 71. But I don't trust my memory all that much. But I think around 71. And that farm-to-table thing took off then. And I think it's hit a second phase now, where you have farm-to-table, but you also have much more creativity. Alice was pretty basic, delicious, phenomenal, still is. But you have people doing things now with cheese and chefs and stuff that they certainly weren't doing 10 years ago.
Not at all. Well, and as I've heard from many people in the business, a couple of vineyard managers in particular, where do you get your groceries from?
Yeah.
They don't come from a grocery store.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of farming around here, yeah.
You're always involved, at least from my point of view, in auction. And you've done Premier, you know, for the very brief period we've been involved. The charity thing's got to be not the easiest thing in the world for you to do, because I'm sure everybody's pulling on you in one direction or another to do this. How do you keep up with this?
Charity, wineries are asked a lot. So, yes, back when I worked for a much larger winery, you basically had to spell out exactly what you could do and couldn't do, or you couldn't communicate to all the people that wanted, you know, a bottle of wine here and a bottle of wine there. To answer your question, the Napa Valley Wine Auction, the dollars go to Napa Valley and the healthcare system. So it's pretty much a no-brainer, I think, for anybody that's in the wine business in Napa Valley to be involved in some way or another, because you are helping everybody that's working for you. You're helping their relatives. You're helping your family. And you're also helping yourself. I mean, it's just one big, huge, connective ball of tissue. So it's a no-brainer. The healthcare of Napa Valley extends itself and has been very proactive in taking care of the farm workers. I would say they're... be interesting if anybody gets back to me with another example, but I cannot think of another county where the farm workers are better taken care of than they are here. And that's with health care services, with low-income housing, pretty much bump, bump, bump. The community really gets behind it. So a huge amount of the dollars from the auction goes into taking care of a lot of people that can't afford health care. Premier Napa Valley is actually bricks and mortar, which is a little bit of a different thing, but that helps support the Vintners Association, which is really the catalyst right now behind the auction. They're the ones that run it, manage it, make it happen. They say we do it, But it's a pretty large organization now that that in my mind runs the auction. I was actually in the steering committee for the very first wine auction.
Oh, were you really?
Yeah.
What year was that again?
I want to say maybe 84. Okay. You know, it was a long time ago. And it was all volunteer. We didn't have Napa Valley Vintners Association, trade organization. It was all winery principals that would just donate their time and get things done. And there's a bunch of us, Bob Mondavi's the one that's quoted the most, but there's a bunch of us that felt that this would be a good thing. And it was a lot funkier back then than it is now.
Funky? How so?
Well, I remember I was in charge of the marketing and the PR for the first auction, and we just sort of all did it on the fly. Mm. We asked a famous British wine authority, Michael Broadbent, to come out and to help us auction off the wines. I think it was the first vintage of Bob Mondavi and Philippe Rothschild's Opus 1 that somebody bought 5 cases of for what we thought was a ridiculous amount of money. It was a couple $100,000, which was a lot of money.
Still is.
Still is.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you just don't look back. It just took off. Everybody wanted to come. So we've gone through a lot of evolutions on the wine auction since then. But for anybody that's come out and attended the wine auction, I've never heard anybody say anything other than that was one of the most memorable experiences in their life. It should be on everybody's that loves wine and food, should be on their bucket list if they haven't come.
Speaking as somebody who comes as media, I can't agree more, especially last year with the uniqueness of the event.
The uniqueness I think you're referring to is that we got a deluge.
The monsoon.
Yes, it was a monsoon. Except it was a cold rain. It wasn't a warm rain.
No, it was not a pleasant rain at all.
I spent some time in Vietnam, and those are warm rains.
Yeah, this was not.
This was.
I remember the sections between the tents where you could get a brief shower as you ran between them.
Well, the smart ones got their limos to go into Steve's Hardware.
I heard that there wasn't anything available.
Yeah, well, they cleaned it out. They cleaned out all the rubber boots at Steve's.
Maybe that made it just that much more fun and that much. And the irony was the previous year with the squirt guns, now that I think about it.
Because it was so hot.
Right.
Yeah. The squirt guns usually come out because it gets so hot.
Yeah.
So I've been in the Valley for every wine auction. I don't think I attended maybe 2-3 max out of all of them. And I, for the life of me, I can't remember a hard rain ever. So that was so odd. The thing that I loved, you could really sit down and eat and drink without heat or any other bother, you know, weather-wise. It was cool. A glass of Cabernet tasted fabulous.
Yeah. It was a great event. It was a lot of fun. I think maybe a little extra silliness because of the rain. It gave us everybody something to giggle about.
Yeah, I think at lunch my chair was sinking into the ground.
Yeah, it got happened with a few people. Yeah.
Yeah, the stilettos, though, were, I was listening to the radios because they were a lot of the volunteers trying to get the whole thing going. Huge volunteer effort here to make it all happen. Volunteers with the radio going, I think we have a stalled stiletto over there on, you know, bump, tent, bump. We need a rescue.
Bring in the chopper. You're right, though, I think, when it comes to the bucket list for anybody who loves wine, whatever it takes, it's an event well worth coming to, not just because of the charity, because of what you get a chance to taste, the people you get to meet, the unpretentiousness of it. And I think that's the most important thing people understand. The friendliest people you're ever going to want to meet, having a great time, and it's all about one thing, well, two things, wine and charity. Yeah. It's excellent. You can't beat that. And it is, of course, coming up at the end of this week, ironically, that we're talking about this.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why you're out here, isn't it?
So, very nice. Well, tell me about this before we go any further in the interview. It's called Rock.
Yeah, well, Rock is a translation of Tor. Tor is our label, and it is Tor Kenward Family Wine. So if anybody's seen the label and had it, little bit about us. We're very small. Most of the wines, again, are through the mailing list. But the French Laundry was our biggest customer in the first 3 to 4 years. And they would buy actually a barrel or two that we would bottle with our label on it. And they would say, you know, selected and bottled for French Laundry, Percy, and Bouchon. So we definitely support the restaurants in there. Now, when I started, I love Rhone wines, but I realized it's a different playground and it's a different mentality. So, interestingly enough, I was looking, okay, I need a label for Rhone stuff because I want to keep it separate. And there was Rock everything, and I wanted Rock in there because Rock's a translation of Tor. Mm-hmm. Tor means high rocky place. My dad was a playwright, and there's a play when I was born called High Tor, and that's the name, the origin of the name. So I tried with, we have to, you know, submit your names and get approval from the ATF. For the name, and no one had taken Rock.
You're kidding me.
I couldn't believe it.
That seems a little obvious, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, and every single vineyard that you think about that is great has Rocks in it.
Right.
We decided it would become Rock, the label for all the Rhone wines. This is a famous vineyard, Lee Hudson's Vineyard, mostly Syrah, with a little bit of Grenache from a little West Paso limestone site that I'm in love with.
Where is that at?
West Paso.
Where is that? You mean as in?
Paso Robles.
Paso Robles, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And the reason for that is that down there, it seems magical with, for whatever reason, with Grenache.
Really?
Yeah, Grenache does things down there it doesn't do in any other part of the world, actually. It gets ripe. It gets dark, and it still has a really, really low pH and good acidity. And it's just, and I love Grenache. Mm. So I've worked from Grenache here. I've worked at Napa Valley. I've done Grenache in Bennett Valley. Worked with some Grenache in Anderson Valley and in Carneros. And it just seems to do certain things down there that are fascinating.
Grenache is something special, and it's, I think, finding the right thing, like you said.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. And if you love Grenache, then you have to maybe look a few places that aren't as close as you'd like them to be.
Maybe sort of like the idea of Pinot.
Isn't this a fascinating wine, though?
It's very, very nice. Like, do you mind if I have a
absolutely,
more?
Absolutely.
And I'm with this cheese, and maybe it's because I'm just enjoying this cheese so much. Thank you. It just goes beautifully with it. The creaminess of it, though, you know, that's just...
Yeah, it's got a real thick middle to it.
We're now obviously in 2012.
Yes.
How did 2011 fare for you?
Business-wise or auction-wise?
Well, I want to talk about the harvest first, and then I'd like to talk about business, too. Yeah.
2011 was one of the strangest vintages I think I can remember, and this is going back to the first real vintage that I got involved in was 77. We had a late start, cool summer with that bizarre rainstorm. The rainstorm created it right at the time, which is now, last year, a huge portion of the valley floor Cabernet was going through bloom and set. And what happened, it was such a hard rain, is that a lot of the flower, the bloom, was just shattered. And we call that shatter.
Right.
So in certain places, depending on the timing on where that cycle was, you had decimation of crop. I had one block in a very famous vineyard that I work with called Tokelon, the Bextoffer Tokelon. where 2 acres of Cabernet was reduced down to less than a quarter of a ton of grapes. Normally, just for the audience, 4 tons an acre is, sort of a standard good set. Not a small set, but a good set. So you get down to a quarter of a ton, which is an eighth of a ton an acre. It's just absurd. A grower looks at it, and grower and producer, and you, it looks like you have nothing to pick. It's that decimated. So that happened to a lot of people. Also, you had to go in because it did get warm at one period, and go through and hand sort, pretty much work through in the vineyard, picking out any sunburn fruit. Mm. The labor that it took to get really good grapes to the crusher stemmer was huge. The crop was small. The quality seems to be very high on those that paid attention. Mm. So the quality aspect of what we have, I'm very excited about. You won't see it for another year or two, on the reds anyway. But what we brought in is really good. Is I think great stuff. But it was hard getting there. It'll be an interesting year because I think some people will do extremely well, and I think some people won't.
And the Torquemard Cabernet, something like that's not going to see the light of day till probably, what are we saying, say around 4?
The 2011 won't come out till, you won't see it till probably January 14.
14, that's what I was guessing. Yeah. So really it's a little bit of wait and see, of course, on your end.
But there's not a lot of it.
Yeah. And how much, when you say not a lot, how much are we not a lot talking about?
I think we're 40% of normal for us. And we only, we're about 1,000 to 1,500 cases. So there's only going to be of all the cabs that we make, and we worked with 4 different vineyards. I think there's going to be 600 or 700 cases of all of it.
That's a great loss.
Yes, it is. It was a tough year. Hopefully this year will be a little easier.
Well, it's been an interesting start so far. It's been a little warmer. Obviously, in the early part of the year, you've had the same kind of crazy weather we've had. Not exactly the same, but comparatively speaking. So where do we go from here then?
Good question. If you got the crystal ball, you're hired.
Mm.
If there was a way of predicting weather, wouldn't life be, it would be a lot easier on us. Larger wineries will hire very, very expensive services that, try their best to predict. But I worked for one that had that kind of service too. And it still is not the panacea. It maybe gives you a little bit of an edge, maybe, but most of the time, no. And maybe that little maybe will save you a lot of anguish, but I would say that would be 1 out of 25 times that you might get lucky by paying all that additional money.
This is something I really like our listeners to hear, especially those who always get so concerned when they see the price on a bottle, because having seen it firsthand myself, the work that goes into a bottle, but the stress that goes into a bottle too with the weather from year to year, and the long-termness. I mean, you're not, you always talk about planting a new vineyard and in 5 years you have usable fruit. I mean, your average investment, you lay down your money now and in 5 years something happens. That's not normal. There's nothing normal about that.
Well, you can extend that out if you want to. So let's say Ray comes up and wants to start a winery and plant a vineyard. All right. So you go and you find the place and you need to plant. So you got your first year where you probably don't get anything in the ground. Second year, you get some really smart people and you get the right rootstock, hopefully, and the right grafting plant material for the top. And it's available, because hopefully you don't have to wait another year. So let's say you get it into the ground. You get into the ground that year. You've got at least 4 to 5 years before you see anything coming into the winery. Five, really, realistically. Six before you have any kind of crop. So you've got 6 years out that you're still writing checks and you haven't been able to sell a bottle of wine because in 6 years, yes, it's at the winery, but it's sitting in barrels. So it's going to sit in barrels for another 2 years and then another 2 years before it really gets out in the marketplace because it needs some bottle age and so on. So you're looking at 10 years where you've been writing checks and substantial ones and you have absolutely nothing coming in. It's
and you didn't even go to the weather there at all, so which is the wild card, right?
Yeah, I mean maybe the first year that you really have a decent crop that you can make a wine out of and put your name and your vineyard on the label, maybe it was a lousy year and just wiped you out.
It's all about farming. So that brings me to the idea of storage. You know, one of the biggest problems I think people have is improper storage when they buy wine they want to lay down.
It's important.
But what about the idea of shipping sometimes? Is that, you know, a lot of wine clubs are very concerned that they won't ship at all during summertime. And of course, they won't ship when, particularly in my part of the country where it can be zero. You know, that's a predicament.
Right. No, it is. Weather and shipping is very important to a winery. I think the industry, certainly I'm talking about Napa Valley, it's very sensitive about the times they ship and how they ship and who they ship with and through. And it is very important. If wine, you know, wine is fragile, but it's not fragile to the point that some people think it is. You just don't want to leave it, you know, much above 70, 75 for long, well, 70 is fine, but I mean 75 or above for periods of time. You don't want it up into the 90s for periods of time. What will happen is the wine will expand and actually start seeping through the cork. You have the cook thing too, but that takes a little bit of work. I'm more concerned about the compromise on the wine and the cork during those things, because it takes a little bit more than most people realize to cook a wine. But you're prematurely aging it in any way when you're exposing it to heat. Wine freezes because it's alcohol at a much lower temperature. So it takes a pretty cold, you know, below freezing. Mm-hmm. Takes a much, I forget what it is to freeze wine, but it takes
a little bit of work.
Yeah, you got to really put that out there someplace.
Sure, but if it's in a warehouse, the potential on a dock, a shipping dock, that kind of thing.
On a shipping dock, yes.
Right.
On a warehouse, it's fine as far as cold.
Right.
I mean, a warehouse that starts getting warm can be a big problem. A lot of wine shipped in styrofoam.
Right.
Styrofoam and heat just holds heat. It's a horrible way to ship wine. If you get warm, because once the styrofoam's warm, it just holds that warmth.
It's almost like a conductor.
Yeah. So, you know, certainly if you're shipping with styrofoam, which most wine is shipped in styrofoam, you really, really, really have to watch the heat. Providence in a wine's very, very important. I think anybody that buys old wine needs to know the providence, where it was, where it came from, if at all possible. It's not always possible, but it's worth getting as much information as you can.
That's just a matter of being a good, well-educated wine drinker.
Yes.
Understanding a July, you know, you're probably not going to drink the stuff if you're buying cases out here. You know, get it shipped in the cooler months. Don't get it shipped in the middle of July. And a lot of wineries aren't even going to do that.
They're not going to let you unless you insist. And I think that's pretty uniform. I don't see wineries shipping voluntarily during, it just doesn't happen anymore. Wineries are very, very sensitive to that. So I think you can pretty much trust the wineries. If you insist on having a wine during a period of time that they're not comfortable shipping, you have to work that out with the winery. You know, obviously you can do 1 day, 2 day. I wouldn't do it more than 2 days, certainly where there's any kind of questionable weather. You know, whether you're from where you're shipping it to where you're receiving it. Yeah, you need to be smart. That's really pretty much it.
Well, the first things I learned when I started coming in Napa Valley was storing wine in a car, one of the best places being on the floor behind
the
seat.
There you go. The trunk gets a little warm on a warm day.
Right. What I always tell people is go to Safeway or wherever, get yourself a little styrofoam container.
Yeah.
Buy a piece of frozen vegetable and throw it in there. You don't need to get ice, just something to keep it cool. Yeah. But more importantly, take it home with you, because you can pay, if you pay $50 for a case to be shipped, same day, you can't pay that in FedEx, can you? It'd be a lot more than that.
Yeah, just don't drink it while you're driving and wave to the CHP as you're going by.
Tor, it's always a pleasure to get together with you. I can't
my
thank you
pleasure.
Enough. So and one more time, too, for our listeners to learn more about you on the web.
Yeah, go to torwines.com. It's pretty simple. TORWINES.com. And you'll see myself. You'll see Susan. You won't see Bella. We should get Bella on there, right?
She's pretty relaxed right now.
Yeah, she is. She's gotten very used to you now.
Yeah, wow. Two visits. I'm in.
You're in. And she's a tough one, too. She's a real critic.
Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Learn more about Tor Kenward Family Wines at torwines.com. Thanks for listening to this program. Watch for our next podcast, which features Steve McPherson of Promise Wines. Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Assistant editor Bob Warner. Original music by Tim Turton. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.